continuing this thread of working with professionals in soil physics, right?
Correct.
Just make sure it's going to load up fine.
Thank you.
Lights up or down?
I think that would be fine.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Ed and Dave. I'd like to talk about teaching soil hydrology, soil physics. If Don mentioned about soil physics to be one of the two areas of soil science that the consultants are needing, and in my opinion, 95% of most consultants are dealing with soil water. So it's very important for them to learn about that. My co-authors here, David Limbaugh is an extension specialist. He does a lot of teaching to through extension workshops, seminars. He's an expert in that area. Mark Vepraskas, he teaches a soils semester course in soil hydric soils, and then they, with Dave Limbaugh, they have also a week-long soil hydric course that they teach a lot of people, a lot of students all over the country. And Josh is our new soil physicist, and eventually he's going to get into these educational parts that I'm doing right now, but after maybe 20 years that I retire, then Josh will have it, so it won't add to his plate. Who are our clients or our students? Consultants. They come from engineering background, geology, hydrology, ecology, botanist, wetland specialists. Then we have government officials. They are sanitarians mainly, engineers, geologists, hydrologists that they work for the government, different government agencies, septic system installers, septic system operators, irrigation system operators, and in addition to all those, we also get soil scientists. It's not that we train them and once they leave the universities, they don't need to be educated anymore. No, that's not the case. What are the academic qualifications? We have students or clients that have PhDs, masters, and most of them have a bachelor degree. And one of the things about the Council of Soil Science Examiners and the licensing that we have, majority of consultants are have a bachelor degrees. So please keep that one in mind. When you train these people, these are the guys and the girls that they go out and will take care of regulations and will design things for you. So make sure that you know you educate them pretty good. We also get community college, high school, and we even may have some people that they don't have any high school backgrounds in our classes. So we have to be aware of that. Why are they attending? Majority of them, the number one is that they want to get the professional development hours. That's the requirement. We have to have 15 credit hours or professional hours for North Carolina every year for licensed soil scientists. So sanitarians have it, the real estate agents have it, everybody has to have those PDHs. So that's really one reason that they take classes. They need to learn to make money. Students on campus, they either have a scholarship, assistantship, they are there to learn. They are not learning there to make money, at least not initially, they don't think about it. But every one of our students that come to these extension classes, to these seminars, they want to make money. They want to go out and use that time to make money. They need to learn as part of their job. If they're employed by a state agency, for example, water quality, subsurface septic systems, anything that they do, they may not have the education when they get into those positions that they have to learn. So they want to learn as part of their job. And some of the points that you have to consider, when you have students in classroom, they're a totally different population than when you have them as part of these classes. Most likely, everybody that has worked with soils, we may get some people that have not had soils background. They may be in a regulatory agency. They just were hired as a sanitarians or regulators, engineer, or somebody that they not have worked with soils. But majority of them, they have worked with soils, so they have some soils background. But we also have to consider not everybody has had a soils course. There's a difference. So maybe a septic system operator that have been working with soils all his life, but has not had any soils course. So we need to keep that one in mind.
I
Not everyone likes mathematics, so that's a really, really important. When I went to North Carolina, I started in 1983, I went to these annual conferences that we have. And as soon as I put the Darcy's Law on the slide there and went out there, half the people, their pens dropped. So soon I learned that I should not talk about anything that has an equal sign in it, at least not immediately. So be careful about that. So not everybody likes mathematics. Not everybody wants to be there. So that's something that's really your job to attract them, to make them understand that they are there for a reason, and that reason is to learn something. You don't want to let them just go, don't ignore them. When I teach a class and I see that the student is not really interested in it, and he's a 25-year-old, I shouldn't say 25, 22, 23-year-old graduate student and doesn't want to learn, I try, but after a while I give up. There is no reason for me to babysit students that are in class. But if I go to one of these classes and I see somebody that doesn't want to be there, I'll try to make him be interested in it. I try to bring him back in there. I have them only for one day or maybe 1 hour or 2 hours or maybe 3 days maximum. So it's a little bit different. There is no exam at the end of it. So whatever you teach them, you have to trust that they have learned it. Or they come back to you later on and you realize that you didn't do a good job. And level of interest changes, varies among all these people. So you have to also keep that one in mind. Length of the course. We have courses that are 1 day, 6 to 7 hours. We have courses that are 2 to 5 days. So we have these students for basically a short period of time. And we have classroom lectures, and we have also field experience for them. So depending on the type of the course, some of them are basically lectures, some of them are lectures and field experience or field exercises. How do we go about it? Unless if you have required a level of understanding of souls, you have to assume that the background that is there is a wide range of background. Don't assume that they have had the beginning souls. Don't assume that they have had your undergraduate soul physics course someplace else. So you have to make that assumption that there is a wide range of backgrounds in there. We ask everyone to introduce themselves, to tell them a little bit what they do, and then we use that one as a sort of propping them to be attentive to what we're going to talk about. We're going to show them how important it is for them to learn what we're going to talk about in their work. Get a feeling of the level of their knowledge and interest. That's very important. And be ready to adjust your presentation. Don't assume that the slides that I have in here are the ones that I'm going to talk about. You have to realize that right there and then, after they introduce themselves, they tell you what they know, you may have to start adjusting things a little bit, or maybe too much. Do not ignore anyone. That's another important thing. These people are the ones that have paid and they have come to your class. If you want them to come back to you, you have to make sure that you are not ignoring them. Try to make sure that everyone learns something. You don't want them to feel that they have wasted their time and money coming to your classes. And I assume that we have done a really good job in that area, because we have a very extensive extension classes, number of classes. We call them Soul Institute that we have. The Dave Limbaugh is very much involved, and Mike Vaprasca sitting back there is involved. And they are getting these classes with 30, 40 students that are willing to pay $500, $600 a piece for a couple of days to come to training. So it's very important to make sure that they understand and they get something out of it. Start by slowly presenting the concept of water flow and water and soul water and soul water movement. Don't assume that they know something. You have to start from basically a square one with these people. Use everyday examples. And I personally like that, because if I tell them something that they can associate with it, they can learn something from it, and they can carry with it. It's a lot easier to understand some concept if they are doing it every day. explain to them why they need to know what you're presenting to them. If I'm talking about water flow, I need to tell them that, okay, you are a septic system installer. You want to go in there. You're going to put a septic system. You put these trenches in. Then the water goes in there. If that water doesn't go away from the soil within 24 hours, you're going to be in trouble because you cannot put another batch of wastewater in there. So they understand that it's important for them to learn, and we try to cover the area that you have to be covered, basically. They make them understand that they can benefit from this financially and professionally. That's very important. If somebody knows that, well, if I learn how to delineate wetlands, I never learn how to do that one in a school, but I'm here for 1 week, if I learn how to do it, I can make money out of it. So they can understand that. Or they can be promoted within their system, within the government, within the profession, consulting firm. Use pictures to show them real worlds. Just don't assume that the slides and the equations can help you. I present you some of the examples of some of the material that we cover. One of them is from Dr. Vepraskas here, Mike Vepraskas, and I modified it a little bit. Talk about wetlands and talk about monitoring, for example, for perch water table. So we showed that you have a sand, a clay, and a sand, and these are the situations that we have very common in the coastal areas in North Carolina. And you say that it rains and it develops a perch water table. Now, if you go in there and you put a well in there, then you can determine where that level of water table is. So you have to make sure that that well doesn't penetrate that clay layer. But if you go there and you put a well that goes deeper, goes through that clay layer, what's going to happen is that water starts moving into this well, and as the water moves, it goes down to the bottom, and soon the water level drops right around there. And as you see here, the water goes to the bottom and it goes out, so you don't see any water in the wells maybe. So you don't assume that you don't have a water table there, because you do have a water table, but you missed it. So we need to make sure that they understand. Soil water potential. We can explain the concept of soil water potential, and I have done that with a number of classes that I have conducted, a two-day class, and I just don't go in there and show them exactly, you know, the way that we do it in soil physics, in soil class, and talk about taking water from one point, putting another point. But we can talk about the concept of soil water pressure head, soil metric potential, soil water pressure head, and submergence potential. So we explain those to them because they need to understand depending on the level of the course that they're in. And also gravitational head. We talk about, why do you express this as the potential as a centimeter as head? And we explain, or I explain to them in my course that, you know, how do we go from this potential into centimeters? Here is, for example, you get a tub of water. You put two capillary tubes in it. One is a diameter of D1. The other one is capillary diameter D2. And D1 is smaller than D2. And water comes into these two capillary tubes. And the example that I always use for them is that I don't know if you remember, if you have done it or not yourself, but some of you have done it. You go to a doctor, they poke your finger a little bit, they bring a little tube next to that place and put it next to that place, suck the blood in there. And majority of the people have seen that one. And they said they don't put any pressure, they don't put any suction on it, because that's a capillary tube, water goes into it. They can understand it. It's one example that they can understand. But in this case, we show them, okay, you have got a small diameter versus a large one, and here we have a higher water level in the small one as opposed to the large one. So as D gets bigger, H gets smaller. And if we need to, we can give them this equation without going through the capillary rise equation, saying, okay, the height of the water is equal to 0.3 divided by D, which is the diameter, but that has to be in centimeters. So we can give them some equations in there, but after at least preparing them for it. Wastewater applied to soils. Majority of our consultants deal with septic systems, so they need to understand how the water applies to the soil. How does water move through soil? Stan Buell, who's a guru in soil genesis and classification, always when I tell him, you know, how does water move through the soil? So, moves through the soil, always through the pores. So explain that one, that water moves through the pore spaces in the soil, whether or not it's soil, saprolite, fracture rocks, or anything that you can think of. I try to explain personally the proportion of the soil and water in the system. Explain that we have a mineral fraction in the soil, we have an organic fraction in the soil, we have air and water, and it's soils that do not expand and shrink, that it stays fairly constant. So if you add water to the system, your air decreases. If you take the water out, air has to replace it. So explain that part to them. Explain the type of the pores that we have in the soil. Here is the inner particle pores, metric pores, pores that are between particles, call a pore spaces in sand, for example. Then we show them, you know, type of the pores that are in tubular pores or planar voids. And tubular pores are like wormholes, root channels, and interfaced faces for planar voids or fractures. Tell them where we can find these. For example, in the AP horizon, we have tubular pores and matrix pores. We perhaps have some interparticle interfaced faces, but generally speaking, you have got more granular structure in the AP horizon. Or you have maybe have some other types, but you have it more of a PET faces in the BT horizon. And talk about what sort of these pores we find in each one of these horizons. Maybe I should darken the room a little bit to see the pictures, if you don't mind it.
Sure.
Yep. Show them some pictures. And here we have some pictures of a BT, BC, and C horizon. For those of you that are not familiar with saprolite, that C horizon is what we find in is a rotten rock, basically. So they can see, and you can see some maybe root channels or root holes in the BT. We describe to them that the BC has got the least amount of porosity that can conduct water in there because you don't have the structure that you have in the BT and you don't have the porosity that you have in the C material. Here is a sandbox that the experiment that we did years ago. Here is the water table and the top of the capillary fringe. And we show them here that this is an example of inner particle pores that flows through sand. Put dye in a trench, and after the dye went out, we show them that, you know, this is how water moves through basically pure sand. And we have them down in our coastal areas. This is another example of an auger hole that we put a red dye, a blue dye in it, and that dye has moved in. This is saprolite. There is no structure in there, and most of the water is basically moving through inner particle pores in there. So you see that in contrast to the next one, which is in BT horizon, and we show them that the most of the water that moves into well-structured BT material is through tubular pores and interfaced faces. There's not much water going in between the inner particle pores or matrix flow, so majority of the flow. So they see the examples and they see some pictures and they can relate with it. I compare water movement through the soil for them through something that they do every day, and that's driving. And for that, I show them the diagram of the basically center part of the city of Raleigh. The red area is where NC State campus is. And you see that capital, that's where the downtown area is. And I tell them, okay, here is a map of the city, here is the street, you put a box around it and look at it to be like a sample of the soil, that you push a core or a cylinder into the soil, bring it out, so you have that. And I ask them, okay, what are the some of the similarities between water flow and driving through town? And they can relate to that driving through town. And believe it or not, they come in and they said that macropore flow because that goes through the major roads in there. Interconnection of the pores. The streets are connected to one another. So if you have got a blockage in there, that macropore is blocked and you cannot go downtown very quickly, you may get into the side streets and go through the side streets. Dead-end pores. We have dead-end streets. So if you go into these dead-end streets, you can't get out. You have to back out of it. So you may have a car in there that may stay in there. Then I talk about the water flow in versus traffic flow in and out of the city. And they can relate with it. introducing Darcy's Law. We eventually do that. Here is one example. We say, okay, I've got a column in there, and that column has got a length, and you put water on top of it. From the top of the water to the bottom of the core is H1. Water flows through this column, and you collect that water, and you look at that volume for a given time. But if you increase that head of the water in there, then your flow increases. We don't need to get into too much description in here, and they can understand that. The more water you have on in top, the faster the water goes through it. Or we say, okay, if you keep the same H2, but if you have got a longer column in there, then you still have got higher head in there perhaps, but water doesn't go through it as fast because you have got a bigger length of the salt core that has to go through it. So prepare them and eventually present the Darcy's Law to them. And by this time, I'm hoping that they will not have any drop pen in the classroom. And we explain in here that the proportionality factor is Ksat in this equation, called hydraulic conductivity. And delta H over L is called the hydraulic gradient. And for your information, everything in the above equation is taken to be positive. We don't make them to worry about that negative sign in there, because if you put the negative sign, you're going to start messing things up. But tell them where the water goes. They have to determine which direction is the water going when they look at this system. So we introduce the Darcy's Law equation to these people. Here is another thing that, you know, do is show them something. And okay, here is a system in here. You have got a bar, you have got a flat area. It's a smooth road versus one that is very bumpy. And you have got two balls and you roll them. Which one gets to the line faster? And they can see that the one that is on top, it moves to the very fast. And the next one is that you have got two that have got a different slope. One is on the slope, one is on an almost flat area. You let the ball go, which one goes to the end line faster? And they can again associate with it that the one that is on a higher slope, it goes faster than the one that goes down. We explain them, okay, here is the Darcy's Law. Velocity is conductivity times that gradient. And you explain that the top one is just like in having a salt that has a higher conductivity versus a lower conductivity, or we have a higher gradient versus a lower gradient when water flow goes through the soil. Believe it or not, I have shown this equation to them, but I explained to them beforehand that do not get scared what you see in there. But that is done after a day of going through all the principles of soil water movement. I'm not saying that you cannot show them this equation, but I guarantee you there will be very few soil scientists that we deal with any type of modeling. Once it gets to be at that level, they hire somebody else or they go to somebody like you and they pay you $200-$300 an hour to come and do the modeling for them. So don't try to teach these people equations like that we do in basically our advanced soil physics or even in your soil physics classes. In summary points, consider background and goal of the people that are attending your workshop, your seminar, your course. Be ready to adjust to your audience. That's very important. You may have a class and the first person introduces himself as a professional engineer, and the last person in the class introduces himself as a septic system installer. And guess what? You have to satisfy both of them. And if you don't, they're not going to show up in your class. And not only they don't show up, they go and tell other people, so that you will not get professional engineers or septic systems installer come to your classes. Be aware of you may not have these people for the next day. It's not like that I teach a class, I make a mistake, I can go back the next day and tell them that, by the way, you know, last time I talked about soil water potential, maybe, you know, I made a mistake in here, or this is what, you know, needs to be done. No, once you talk to these people, they are gone. So think about your reputation and make sure that, you know, you explain everything to them. Make sure that they understand what you're teaching, and make sure that there is no error in your presentation. and consider that your audience has paid to be there and they expect to learn something that will help them with their job. And I tell all my students, I teach a course called Environmental Application of Soil Science, and I taught soil physics for a couple of years before Josh joined us. And I tell them, you better learn in here, because if you don't learn in here, then you have to come back and pay me $400 a day to learn. And that's the nature of it. Not that I get that money in my pocket, but that's what the cost is for them, $400 or $500 maybe for 2 or 3 days workshop. And with that, I stop.
Okay, thank you very much, Aziz. Questions or comments for Aziz?
Yes.
I'm curious, and maybe I missed it in your opening slide. Are you having NRCS soil scientists?
We have had NRCS soil scientists in our classes. I taught one. I actually went to Minnesota first part of August. Soil Science Society of Minnesota, I don't know what they call them, but anyway, it was the Soil Science Society. And there were a good portion of the class, maybe about 20, 25% of NRCS people. So yes, we get them in our classes. Yes?
And do you actually use the SI unit or system units? Or?
We use both of them. We try to, these people are dealing with feet and acres, so we have to be cognizant of that. But we are still teaching, you know, about centimeters and try to tell them, you know, 40, you know, 30 centimeters. You have to be flexible. And most of the regulations are in inches and feet. So we have to be aware of that.
Water flow is always CFS, right?
No.
We're not the only one. Other comments?
And if I have one word for you, in North Carolina, you cannot practice soil science unless if you're a licensed soil scientist. And we convinced engineers, because they were the biggest, professional organization, that they're very powerful. We convinced them that the soil scientists can do soil hydrology. The geologists tried to push us out, say that you cannot do any soil hydrology work. But we convinced them, now it's in our regulations, that the soil scientists, professional, licensed soil scientists, professional engineers, and licensed geologists can do hydrogeology work. So we do hydrogeology work as soil scientists. And that really comes from our soil physics background. So please get involved with your state organizations and try to promote soils. Otherwise, we will be pushed out.
Any comments in general on teaching?
Yeah, I reckon